So where were we? I have no idea where we were. We must have been somewhere.
Why don't we go with your question?
Okay, I'll try to formulate this question. I can feel it when I'm looking for the words. The question has to do with if non-self is, if the Buddha declined to answer that question because it would have been confusing because neither is the case, then how did non-self ever get into the three? Why does it appear in these three conditions?
Well,
what is the significance of that?
Okay, that's a good question. It's a translation issue a little bit. What the Buddha was challenging was the notion of Atman, that is the essential self. So remember when I said earlier there were a number of approaches going on because samsara was a problem. And so there were those who thought, well, the solution to the problem of samsara is a transcendental solution, that there's this essence acting behind the world of phenomena. There's this one, the many, multiplicity is unreal, it's an illusion. There's this one acting behind the scenes known as Brahman. And what you are is an Atman, an essential self, and there's the essence of reality. But the essential self and the essence of reality are basically the same thing. Well, they're not basically the same thing. They are identical. So that's the transcendental solution. Then there was a skeptical solution, the Ajivika skeptics who said, well, we don't really know. Any opinion is as good as every other opinion. They were basically skeptical relativists. And then there were the people like Vakogatha who were just confused. And so the Buddha looks at all of this and he says, well, eternalism seems like a bad idea because it's not warranted by experience. And what he said was an Atman in Sanskrit. It means no Atman. Anatta is the Pali for no Atman. It means no essential self. It doesn't mean no self. It's a translation issue. So that thing comes down to Buddhists who think, well, there's no self. The Buddha never said that. He said there wasn't an essential one. See, if you say there's no self, that's annihilationism. That's the other extreme, which he was not terribly fond of. So the middle way is to say, well, you really can't say there's a self, and you really can't say there's not a self. The self is an unfolding process, and you can't fix it in time. There's a self, but you can't say, well, there it is, because the self is dependently produced, and dependent production, well, this is going to probably push the limits of vocabulary and understanding, mine too, but the self, dependent production is a nonlinear system. So we tend to think linearly. So if you look at, you guys know the factors of dependent production? There's 12 of them.
Some.
And I don't have them memorized. They're my notes here, but it begins with dependent production of suffering. Begins with ignorance. And then in the translation that I like best goes to fabrications and consciousness and name and form and sense media, contact, feeling, birth and death, becoming. There's a couple of others because I just named eight and there's 12. I could look at my notes
grasping
and give you
all attachment.
Grasping. Yeah, they're in there. And I could appeal to my notes, but I don't want to do that because it's really not that important. So we tend to think of that as a linear system because people are comfortable thinking that way. But it's not obvious that the Buddha thought that way. And then what people did was try to understand it as a circle and represent the dependent production as a 12-spoked wheel. But the Buddha never described it that way. He described it as an entanglement. That is, I mean, if you just took a big string and gathered it all up, there it would be. It's all entangled now. And so when you look at things as a linear system, it looks as if, well, this happens first, and this happens second, and this happens third. And if you wrap it around in a circle, you don't really solve that problem. It's just that in a linear system, things begin and things end. In a circular system, they just keep on continuing, but one step follows another step. But that's not what dependent production is. That's not what a self is. A self is a non-linear system. A self is like a weather front. So think about a weather front. I mean, a powerful weather front. It's got winds and clouds and thunder and lightning, and it's interacting with the geography of what it's passing over. It's really a complex system, which we can't figure out at all. Because as any one element in the system changes, the whole system changes. Probably a more concrete example would be something like dieback phenomena, animal populations. So nature balances animal populations by what's called a dieback phenomenon. So if there's a lot of prey species, then you get more predators surviving because they have more to feed on. As you get more predators surviving, they feed on the prey population. The prey population drops, but now the predators start to starve. But that's a nonlinear system. Supposing, for example, you had an alpha predator who falls off the edge of a cliff. Well, that changes who gets preyed upon, doesn't it? And let's say a predator attacks a male of a prey species and kills it. Well, that has one effect, but if it attacks and kills a pregnant female, that's far more consequential because she would have given birth to many more prey. I mean, it changes the entire system. And there's no way to predict how any of that's going to unfold. The system's too complicated. And that's true of the weather. That's true of dieback phenomena. That's true of financial markets. I mean, do you really think if these people on Wall Street could figure out financial markets, they would, and they would make even more money than they're making? I mean, they've rigged the system. I think we could all agree on that. But what's going on, of course, is they can't really figure out how financial markets operate. If they could, well, if they could, we all would have invested in Apple when it first started. And 10% of Apple, if you invested in it right off the bat, you would be worth $37.5 billion right now, which is probably going to enable you to feed your family. But nobody could predict that. So these kinds of phenomena are way too complex to figure out, and that's kind of the bad news. But the good news is, if you change any one aspect of a complex system, you change the whole system. So even though dependent production is an extremely complex nonlinear system, which makes it intellectually interesting, the good news is that its very complexity enables the whole system to be unraveled if you can just figure out what place you would like to go. So the dependently produced self, right? The so-called no self. Well, it's dependently produced, and it suffers. What happens is the Buddha understood that what we do is construct a suffering self. We construct a self that's, well, designed to suffer. Not because there is pain, but because we shoot ourselves with this particular arrow. So if you understand how dependent production, I guess unfolds is a good enough word, how dependent production unfolds, and you understand it's, they're not really like component parts so much as they're aspects. I mean, you don't think of thunder as a component part of a weather front. And you really don't think of wind or lightning or clouds as component parts of a weather front. those things make up the weather front. But if you take one of them out for whatever reason, the weather front changes. So if you look at the dependent origination of the suffering self, it's composed of aspects. But the aspects are not linear. They sort of fold back on one another. So let's... there are 12 steps. I'm basically fond of three of them. And that's because of my particular set of interests. You might end up being fond of some others. So, in accordance with the component parts of dependent production, begins with ignorance. Ignorance of what? Well, ignorance of dependent production in the first place, and the Four Noble Truths in the second place. So the Buddha thought, suffering starts there. If you're ignorant of the truth of dependent production, and if you're ignorant of the Four Noble Truths, you're going to suffer, and it'll just continue. Well, if you're Buddhist, you sort of take that stuff for granted. There's dependent production, there's the Four Noble Truths, there's the three marks, and that's... Okay, so no need to start there, we'll just stipulate that. The next move is fabrication. That is, we make stuff up. I like that one. That resonates with me because I teach comparative stuff. And I've seen all the stuff people make up. So you make up this, Socrates made up that, and Plato made up this other thing, and Epicurus made up the third thing, and the Upanishads made up the fourth thing, and the Sanatana Dharma is the fifth thing, and monotheism is the sixth, seventh, and eighth thing. And so now you have all these things that people are making up. So, fabrications. Then consciousness, because I think consciousness is kind of cool because nobody can account for it. And then I'm a big fan of clinging. Not that I think it's a good thing, but I think when you look at the dependent production of suffering, a good understanding of clinging will help you sort of unravel the process. But let's go back to earlier stages. Fabrication. Now, you might think fabrication is sort of simple. It's just linear. You fabricate. And so you start with ignorance. And because you're ignorant, you fabricate. But for the Buddha, fabrication was not simple. Fabrication was complicated. There's four types of fabrication. There's the body and breath is fabricated. And you might think, how's the breath fabricated? Well, did you ever catch yourself breathing rapidly? Did you ever catch yourself breathing slowly? Did you ever catch yourself breathing irregularly? Well, that's fabrication, isn't it? You make that up. Could you breathe more slowly on a regular basis than you actually do? In other words, could you reduce your breathing rate? Well, sure you could. You probably do when you practice. Now, has your usual breathing rate slowed to that point where you achieve what you achieve when you practice this morning? Is your normal breathing rate the same as your sitting breathing rate? Well, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But if it isn't, it's because under one set of circumstances you fabricate one breathing rate, and under another set of circumstances you fabricate another breathing rate. Think about your body. Well, your body's a fabrication, right? If you lived some other way, you would have a different body than you have. If you ate worse, or exercised less, or exercised more, or ate better, or ate differently, your body would look differently. So the body and the breath are fabrications. We construct that. So that's one fabrication. Psychophysical processes, another fabrication. Notice that? Just scratched an itch. What happened? What happens when you scratch an itch? Think about it for a moment. You scratch an itch, what happened? How'd that work? Go ahead, give me some. What happened?
The itch goes away.
After you scratch it. So, for that point, that part will never itch again in human history?
Maybe not.
But you're not sure, are you? But what happens when you itch? What happens? Is that a fabrication too? Do sharks get itches? Would it make any sense for a shark to have an itch?
You couldn't scratch it.
Well, they probably could. Well, they could. They could rub up against the rock. But do they have the kind of physical form that has itches in the first place? Well, we don't know. But you have the kind of physical form that has itches. So when you scratch an itch, what happens? Is it just itch scratch? Is that all? Or something else go on? Did you ever have an itch that was not sufficiently annoying such that you didn't scratch it, but you identified it as an itch? So in order for you to scratch an itch, there's a physical process, the perception of the sensation of something you identify as an itch. Then it gets to be sufficiently annoying so that then you decide to scratch it, and then you do. Or you start to, if neuroscience are correct, you start to scratch it, and then you decide to scratch it, and then you act on the scratching. So an itch is actually a complex psychophysiological process. Because at some point you could decide not to scratch an itch. I'll bet you've decided not to scratch some itches sometime in your life. What happened to the itch?
Goes away.
It doesn't last forever. It may get a little bit more annoying, because if it started off annoying in the first place, typically if you leave it alone, it doesn't get less annoying. It gets more annoying. But if you hang in there for a while, it goes away. So just something as simple as an itch. A physical itch is a complex psychophysical process. Now think about itches like success, wealth, fame, power, sexual itches, romance itches, greedy itches, hateful itches. If a simple physical itch is that complex, imagine how complex those other kinds of itches are. And we fabricate that. Your body has the capacity to itch, but it's possible for you not to get annoyed by the itch. I mean, some people get annoyed by itches that you don't get annoyed by. Some people have status itches that you don't have, wealth itches that you don't have, power itches that you don't have, romance itches that you don't have, or maybe you have some that they don't have. So because of the kinds of beings we are, we itch in particular ways. Or don't. But that's a fabrication, because we don't all itch in the same way about the same kinds of things. So now we have breath and body fabrications and psychophysical fabrications and thoughts, mental fabrications, memories, imaginings, speculations, fantasies, they're all fabrications. We make that stuff up. So, this morning, I'm doing this. Well, naturally, I thought about doing this. Well, it's a total fabrication. I had no idea how this morning was going to turn out. I really didn't know what I was going to say. Well, I sort of knew what I was going to say because I was tasked with talking about the three seals. But I had no idea how it would go. But it went some way in my mind. But that was a total fabrication. I just made that up. I know enough at this point in my career not to take my speculations on those issues very seriously, because I know it's just completely made up and it's going to turn out, well, some other way. But your thoughts, in effect, are fabrications. You just make up the world thought-wise. You can think the world differently. So we were talking about that a little bit last night, Stuart, when if you take any experience whatsoever, pick an experience, and you think about that experience, is it possible to think about that experience some other way? Just one other way? Two other ways? Five other ways? 22 other ways? Well, maybe we're pushing it a little bit. There are probably not an infinite amount of ways that you can think about any experience whatsoever, but there's more than one, which means, of course, you have options, which means the way you think about the world is a fabrication. You could think about it some other way. The world doesn't have to be thought the way you think it. It could be thought some other way. I mean, just look at the world. There are plenty of worldviews on the planet. Plenty of people who have what you would think is the same experience you had, and you don't come to the same conclusion that they came to at all. It's another fabrication. And phenomena in general is a fabrication. We see and hear 1% of the visual and auditory spectrum. That's a really tiny fraction of the visual and auditory spectrum. And even there, we're fabricating. Tree. Phenomenal world. So when you see a tree, what are you seeing? You're thinking, well, I'm seeing a tree. Well, do squirrels see the same tree you see? I mean, they see a place to live. You probably don't think of living in a tree. They see a place that provides food, but most trees don't provide food for us. We'll think of, a pine tree, for example. Or, an oak tree. Let's do an oak tree. Because you could probably eat acorns. Can we eat acorns? Are they edible for humans? Does anybody know? See, we don't know. That means we haven't fabricated in that direction. So now you have four ways to fabricate the world. Body and breath, thoughts, psychophysical processes, and phenomena. Turns out that they are the four foundations of mindfulness. Now, if you're doing Vipassana, the foundation of mindfulness that you're interested in is the breath, right? You do breath work. Focus on the breath. The Zen guys don't do that. Typically, they focus on phenomena at large. You know, what is the sound of one hand clapping? Well, that's sound. You know, that's phenomena. Or you could focus on bodily states. Or you could focus on your thought processes. I mean, the Buddha taught the four foundations of mindfulness because he knew that there were four types of fabrications. And they fold in on one another. And they feed ignorance or disable ignorance. If you're ignorant in a particular way, then you fabricate in a particular way. If you stop fabricating in that way, you stop ignorance in that fashion. And it basically generates a feedback loop. It's not a linear process at all. So you start out with at least two ways to be ignorant, of dependent production and of the Four Noble Truths, but that could be far more than two. And then you have four kinds of fabrications, and now you have four things feeding in on two, six, or eight things and interacting with each other. That's not a linear system at all, and there's no way to predict how that works. Next step after fabrications is consciousness. Now, the consciousness gets real complex because it's one of the aggregates. Everybody know the aggregates? Yes, no, maybe?
Review quick. Or name them.
Quick fast. Aggregates. Okay. Form. Feeling. Recognition, sometimes translated as perception. Form, feeling, recognition. Volitions, consciousness. Those are the five aggregates. Those are what composes. It's one way of understanding the constructed nature of the so-called no-self. So consciousness exists at every level. That is, once again, the aggregates are not discrete. They sort of fold in on one another. They're all a part of this process. So that when you encounter a form, you have encountered the form. And as soon as you encounter a form, you have feelings about it, either a plus feeling, orientation towards that form, a minus feeling, going away from that form, and your body will have a neutral feeling. But your mind doesn't. Your body, your mind doesn't do neutral, according to what the Buddha taught. Your mind does only plus minus. Your mind is subject to, well, allure and aversion. That's it. It goes towards or away from. There's no neutral in your mind. Well, for most people, you could get into states where you're so composed and serene that there's a kind of basic neutrality, but you don't want to push that too far, I don't think. So now we have these five components. They're all interconnected and intermeshing, and those create one of the four fabrications, which feed on ignorance. So now you have five aggregates and four fabrications and a bunch of types of ignorance. And so now three components of dependent production now end up as a minimum of 11, which are creating feedback loops. You see how it begins to get impossible to say is or is not, because the system is so complex. And that's what makes it intellectually interesting. That's what makes it psychologically interesting. But as far as solving the problem is concerned, all I have to do is not fabricate unconsciously in one area for the entire system to start to come apart. So you can disentangle. See, all of those things are like entanglements. And you can disentangle the entanglements by disentangling one thing. So let's say I got this ball of string here and it's all entangled. And I just focus in on one entanglement and do that, and the whole thing just disentangles. It's doable. If you change one aspect of a weather front, you change the entire weather front. If you change one aspect in financial markets, you change financial markets. If you change one aspect in dieback phenomena, you change the whole set of interactions that are going to go on from that point on. Yes?
I learned the dependent origination as a wheel, as a circle. And it was my understanding that there was the place that you break into it is grasping, is where between pleasant, unpleasant, and grasping or aversion. Is that saying the same thing as you're saying non-fabricating?
No. See, what that narrative says is you can only solve the problem at one place. Mm-hmm. What I think the Buddha is saying is that you can solve the problem of the dependent production of suffering at many places. Supposing this grasping thing is not something that resonates very well with you. Maybe fabrication resonates better. Maybe consciousness resonates better. I don't know. If the system is that complex and in truth can be unraveled any place, then there's many places you can insert yourself so that the Dharma is available to all sorts of people who have all kinds of psychological predispositions. You don't have to have just this one that focuses in on grasping or clinging or whatever. It seems to me, if you look at it the way I think the Buddha was saying, is it makes the salvational capacity of his teaching more general and more available to more people, which makes it superior. I mean, I love Sigmund Freud because he was so wrong about so many things. But so here you have Sigmund Freud. Repression is very bad, right? Because if you repress, then you get neurotic symptoms which pop out somewhere and you can't control them because most of your psychological processes are out of your control. 90%, he said, of your psychological processes are unconscious. Actually, he seems to have been right about that. Although neuroscientists will say it's more like 95% rather than 90%. So his solution was expression. So you, if you don't repress stuff, the solution is to express stuff. But he had a particular way of expressing things. And that meant psychoanalysis, and you express yourself in dreams and in free associations and in whatever that, what's that other one, where you, so-called Freudian slips, where you express, okay. Well, the problem with psychoanalysis is that it's terribly expensive and time-consuming and largely doesn't work. So are those your only two options then? Expression, repression? Well, not as far as Buddha was concerned. You could have calm, conscious awareness of your emotional experiences so that you're not expressing them, but you're not repressing them either. They come into consciousness, you view them dispassionately, and they go away like every itch goes away. But you're aware of the itch, at least. It's not an unconscious process anymore. So if dependent production is correct, it offers you an enormous number of opportunities to enter into the system, not at just one place. If you look at the history of Buddhism, not the teaching of the Buddha, Buddhism, everybody fastens on something else. I'll just go through this. I don't know how much you know about the history of Buddhism. But you get people like Nagarjuna who fastens on concepts and says, well, concepts are the problem. And you get people like Buddhaghosa, almost the same time in India, different locations. And Buddhaghosa wrote The Path of Purification, talked a lot about jhanas. I don't know how many of you are familiar with jhanas, but there are different forms of consciousness, and there are form jhanas and formless jhanas, and he focuses on that, and he thinks that formless jhanas are really the biggest deal, and the Buddha never said anything like that. In fact, I think he rejected them, the formless ones at least. And the Zen masters talk a lot about, well, whatever you do with a pure heart spontaneously or a pure mind spontaneously is okay. The Buddha never said that. Some Buddhists talk about bare attention. The Buddha never mentions bare attention, whatever bare attention even means. I'm not even quite sure. So you see all these things in Buddhism that take an aspect of dependent production and emphasize it. And that'll work. But if you do that, what tends to happen is you get sectarianism, where the Zen guys say one thing and the Tibetan guys say another thing. There was a big conference, I don't know, it's about 1300, about 700 years ago, where Chinese Zen masters had a meeting with Tibetan masters. And after weeks of conferring, they basically agreed to disagree. So you have two groups of people calling themselves Buddhist that aren't coming to the same sets of conclusions at all. But that's based upon, I think, a fundamental misunderstanding of dependent production. If dependent production is correct, then you could enter into the system any place, and there's plenty of room for a variety of opinions, a variety of orientations, all trying to solve the same problem. And that's the problem of the dependent production of suffering, if you're interested in problem solving. If you're interested in attaining nirvana, well, that's a different set of conditions. What Buddhists tend to focus on is the Buddha's diagnosis, not the Buddha's prognosis. So if you focus in, this was interesting because Jamie did a web search. In Buddhist scriptures, the Buddha talks about the dependent production of suffering, 12 steps. He also talks about the dependent production of nirvana, also 12 steps. We did a web search. We couldn't find it anywhere. You can't find the dependent production of nirvana anywhere on Google, right? Why not? It's there, right, in the scriptures. Why not? Because India was the kind of country where samsara was the overriding problem. It was repetitive misery. And so you focus on the disease aspect of things. And so the Buddha adopts a role as a kind of physician, where he's going to take a look at the disease aspect of things and show you how not to be diseased anymore. And many forms of Buddhism just fasten on that. So that's really all you hear about, is the dependent production of suffering. Maybe you're not all that fond of that. I mean, I don't think that, for some Americans, that doesn't resonate very well. It seems like it's pessimistic, that they'd rather something else. You know, we think that happiness is our birthright because, well, that's what Thomas Jefferson promised us, right? You have the inalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So we think, well, happiness, that's kind of our deal. We don't like to think about suffering. It's unsettling. It's pessimistic. We don't even want to go there. Okay. Buddhists could just as easily talk about the dependent production of nirvana, except you don't see it anywhere. You can't even find it in a Google search. And let's assume that Google knows everything about everything. It's not there. So clearly they don't know about this. They could. We can talk about it after lunch. So back to where we begin after that long tangent that I just went off on. What happens is that Buddhism takes the teaching of the Buddha and fastens on one aspect of dependent production, and then says, well, this is how you do it. Well, the Buddhist teaching is more complex than that. It's more rich than that. It's more diverse than that. It's more various than that. Now, sometimes for salvational purposes, you have to simplify things. Now, could the Buddha have said to Vakugatha, listen, Vak, here's what's going on? Because, you know, he was a friendly guy, would have called him by his nickname. Boy, that was an unsuccessful joke, wasn't it?
It took a while.
So anyway, I mean, he could have explained this whole process thing, this whole dependent origination thing, but apparently the Buddha was very sensitive to the confusion that this poor man was in. And out of compassion, he realized that if he went into this explanation of what was actually going on, the man would have just been more confused, and he wasn't going to help him at all. So he thought the best thing to do was not answer his question. I suppose in hopes that over the course of time he would be less confused. But telling him that it either was or it wasn't, there either was a self or there wasn't a self, would have made him more confused and sent him down roads that would have been, well, even less beneficial to the man's life. So some of the Buddha's teaching seems to be oriented towards who is listening. So remember I said in the Maha Parinibbana Sutta that the Buddha says all compounded things are subject to decay, by which he meant everything. So this is kind of the last thing he says, because he's saying this on his deathbed. Well, he also says to one of his disciples, if you see a beautiful woman, avert your eyes. Now, some people think what the Buddha is saying is, don't look at beautiful women. He's not saying that. He's talking to this guy, because apparently this guy has a problem with lust. And the Buddha knows this. So he's telling him, you need to do this. That doesn't mean everybody needs to do that. It means you need to do that. So sometimes people, the scriptures are read in such a fashion that you think the Buddha is making a general statement that applies to everybody in all circumstances, when he's actually not doing that. He talked to Vakugatha personally. That's why he wouldn't answer the question, because of this man's circumstance. He talked to that lustful disciple personally. He wasn't talking to everybody. He wasn't making a denigrating comment about women. He was saying, you have a problem here, and you need to fix this. That's very different from saying something general. So it's very difficult to know in scripture just what the point is. So in order to figure that out, you need context. You need to know something about what things lead up to. I mean, why is the Buddha talking about fire in the first place? Why is he talking about food or sustenance? Why is he talking about dependent production and process? Why is he talking about that stuff? Well, he's talking about that stuff, as I hope you understand at this point, because that's how the intellectual tradition of the time dealt with problems, except not for the dependent production thing. He's the first one who ever thought of that. That makes total sense to us now, because science understands that things are connected to other things, and the reason you get one sort of circumstances is because of this prior set of circumstances. So we intuitively almost agree with that now, but that was an insight at the time that nobody had before. You could look in vain in any intellectual tradition on the planet prior to the Buddha for that understanding of things. You simply won't find it. He founds that understanding. It's the same understanding that science is based on. Although science is interested in the natural world, the Buddha really wasn't. He was interested in human experience. He thought that if you don't solve the problem of how humans behave, we're going to use what we know about the natural world badly. And isn't that exactly what we're doing? I mean, look at science used horribly badly. Nuclear fission, nuclear bombs, laser guidings, well, laser-guided smart bombs, stickier napalm. You know, we take this and use it badly because, well, we don't understand ourselves very well. If we understood ourselves better, maybe we would take these kinds of tools and use them a lot better. So what's the real problem? Is the real problem not understanding the world? Or is the real problem not understanding ourselves? Socrates comes to the same conclusion about 100 years later. The real problem is not understanding ourselves. Because anything at all, can be used badly. And if you're predisposed to using things badly, having more sophisticated tools means you're going to use those sophisticated tools, well, worse. 19th century, there were 125 wars, according to the people who study these issues at West Point. In the 20th century, there were 119. There were actually slightly fewer wars in the 20th century than in the 19th century. But the wars in the 20th century were far more murderous. Why? Well, because of the technologies of death, right? Had machine guns in the 20th century, didn't have all that many of them in the 19th. Had napalm in the 20th century, nuclear weapons in the 20th century, didn't have those in the 19th. Had airplanes in the 20th century, tanks in the 20th century, didn't have those in the 19th. So we got slightly better behaved, actually, in the 20th century, but more murderous, because we didn't solve the problem of ourselves. We're right at noon. Okay. Well,
is that a depressing place to stop?
See what? What's that?
Is that a depressing place to stop?
It would be less depressing if I could ask one quick question before we eat. Is that okay? You're the timer.
Well, I'll try not to be long-winded.
Yeah, don't be long-winded.
Or if I'm going to be long-winded, I'll have to answer that later.
So the Western ego-laden person comes to the Buddha thinking I'm a fixed self, thinking I got to protect myself and my tribe and other people are out there and I'm in here and it's all about me, and ask, is there a self or no? And the Buddha says, no self. Is that the way we understand that?
The Buddha probably would say to a Westerner who is reasonably well educated, you're making an elementary mistake. Here's how things actually are. See if you can wrap your mind around this.
But I think that's where no self comes from, in terms of how we tend to embrace it in Western Buddhism, it seems like. It's not that fixed self. That's what we define.
We define a self as. In Western culture, we define a self as free, unique, autonomous, rights-bearing, and individual. That's how we define a self. But if you think about that form of a self, it's really problematic. Since if you're unique, think about anything unique. If it's totally unique, how does it relate to anything else on the planet? In order to have a relationship with anything else on the planet, you can't be unique. You have to have something in common with that other thing. So what's one of the big problems in Western culture? Alienation. Well, the Western concept of the self really sows the seeds for alienation, discontent. As soon as you think of the self that way, it becomes a burden, and a terrible one at that. The Buddha is trying to unburden us of that, because he understood the problem 2,600 years ago. Unfortunately, it hasn't gotten as much traction as it should have. But it's your job.
But that's a more optimistic place to be.
Yeah. I thought so. Thanks. It depends on how much you want to protect yourself when you hear stuff like that.
We'll get real optimistic after lunch. I promise.